morning, everybody. Welcome to the Winds of Change here at CFUV Radio 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable dial. And on the internet, we're heard around the world at cfuv.uvic.ca. My name is Janine Bancroft, and we have a special post-apocalyptic show today, or perhaps pre-apocalyptic, for those of you who happen to be keeping an eye on the alternative media reports of what's going on at Fukushima. The corporate media, I guess, is busy with other important things like hockey, and of course we're cheering the Canucks on, but at the same time there are important things that are under-reported, and certainly what's going on at Fukushima is one of them. It's a little bit scary, but we're here today, and I am broadcasting live from unceded Lekwungen Coast Salish territory at the beautiful University of Victoria. And in the next hour, I've done something a little bit different. I've pre-taped the show today on the Monday after the day the world didn't end. I spent an hour chatting with Rob Wypond about some of his research regarding BC's Mental Health Act, shocking research, and about big pharma and pharmaceutical drugs and how all of that works. And we had an interesting discussion about just what we call mental illness, what are other ways of thinking of that and viewing that, and how do other cultures deal with it and all that kind of stuff. Rob Wypond, for folks who are not familiar with him, he writes for Focus Magazine. He's a freelance writer. He has been for a couple of decades, and he does research and writing. He's a regular columnist now for Focus Magazine. He also works as a sessional instructor at UVic and Royal Roads, and he contributes to sometimes to songwriting or theatrical productions or yoga. So all around good guy, and really important research that he's been doing in this field, and will be writing about in the June issue of Focus upcoming. So if what you're about to hear is of interest to you, definitely go pick up the June Focus magazine. I'm going to play about 20 minutes, and then we'll have a little break, and I'll play some music, and we'll come back and listen to the second half of that. But it is about 50 minutes, so I'm just gonna get started with that. So stay tuned. You're listening to CFUV Radio 101.9 FM. So, Rob, at the event with Robert Whitaker, you mentioned some research you had done about the BC Mental Health Act that I found quite shocking. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I always want to talk about it because a lot of people don't know just how bad our Mental Health Act is. And I'm not the only one to say this. Just about any lawyer you put the Mental Health Act in front of, their jaw will drop off. Because most lawyers, there's not like a lot of money in prosecuting mental health issues, as you might imagine. It's not a big money industry to defend people who've been declared mentally ill. So not many lawyers have even ever looked at it. But when they do, they're quite shocked, and understandably so. And we're, in fact, sort of renowned around the world for our Mental Health Act, which a lot of people don't realize. And the reason is because about 10 years ago in particular, the manager of clinical psychiatry in British Columbia and the BC Schizophrenia Society and a number of other groups that are very pro-forced treatment, they really believe that people should be incarcerated against their wills and treated with drugs and or electroshock against their wills. They believe it helps people. And even when people resist, even after they've been treated, they believe that despite the fact that you are saying, I don't like it, I haven't enjoyed it, it's not helping me, if they decide that it's helping you, they really believe in just continuing to force you to do that. So we've actually set up an amazingly strong legislative set of tools to allow that to occur. And essentially what it does is it gives absolute discretion to an individual doctor, and then a sort of ceremonial sign-off by a second doctor. You might be just the director of the hospital or whoever, to incarcerate virtually anyone and treat virtually anyone against their wills.
And okay, so wait. So when you say we've set this up, mm-hmm. It's not you and I setting this up.
Right.
Is this the BC Liberals?
Well, in fact, I have to say that historically the NDP neither have been particularly pro-patient rights. So this is something that's kind of deeply embedded in our society right now. Like, I do think that there's if you talk to people about their attitudes about mental health and mental illness, there actually people tend to believe that we have the science to support forced treatment. They think that, yes, we know that mental difficulties are actually illnesses. We know how to cure them. These drugs are what cures them. So just give these to people. They'll be happy. They'll thank us. It's like kind of picking somebody up from a car accident. Would you not take them to the hospital, get them properly treated, even though they couldn't, you know, they weren't conscious enough to say yes, please, because they've just been hit by a car? Of course you do that. Well, why wouldn't you take a person who was, you know, having some sort of emotional disturbance in their lives to the hospital and be properly treated? That's most people's vision. So there is something endemic to our society. That said, there's definitely strong movement, and that is within... I wouldn't really put it to the particular government. I think it's some of the bureaucrats that were involved. Dr. John Gray being a very important player in this. And I can mention him. I think, in fact, he would be proud that I, you know, link him to this. He was the manager of clinical psychiatry during the time when some of these changes were made. He did tell me in an interview that it was really sort of family members of people who have been diagnosed with mental illness who were kind of pushing this agenda primarily. And he subsequently left. When he left the BC government, he now is one of the directors of the BC Schizophrenia Society. And he was recently featured in a series of Globe and Mail articles about the state of mental health across Canada as one of, you know, the most esteemed national experts on mental health law. And in particular, he's a very strong advocate of forced treatment. So because of that, that's one of the primary reasons we have the Mental Health Act we do. And I just like to read it out to people who doubt me. It's section 22 of the Mental Health Act. And let's see, I have it here somewhere. So section 22 of the BC Mental Health Act says that you can be involuntarily admitted and treated against your will if you require care, supervision, and control in or through a designated facility, that would be a hospital. And this, for the reasons, these are the reasons: to prevent the person's or patient's substantial mental or physical deterioration, or for the protection of the person or patient, or the protection of others. So that's really important to look at that wording, because it used to be, and people would assume, that it had something to do with danger. Perhaps you were threatening suicide, or you were, throwing a bicycle chain in the air while you walk downtown. I cite this because I've seen someone do this, you know, and we throwing a bicycle chain around and endangering people's lives and just acting strangely. And so people thought that's when you can be incarcerated. But no, in fact, all that has to happen is that a doctor decides you might experience some form of mental or physical deterioration, whatever that might be. It's not defined in the legislation. It's not defined in the science. It's not defined in the regulations. It's not defined anywhere. Or if it's just for your protection or the protection of somebody else. So essentially, this gives absolute discretion to that individual doctor, psychiatrist, to incarcerate you. And the next part of this is important to understand, is we've created two other components. This can be indefinite. There's no length, there's no prescribed length of time. So we, in fact, have some people in Canada who've never committed a crime, Scott Starson being a famous one. He's basically Canada's version of a Beautiful Mind. He actually took this to the Supreme Court. Now, he's been in jail, I forget, it's like a decade or more. Never charged
in
with anything.
In jail.
Not in jail, sorry, incarcerated in a hospital. But it's a jail. I mean, for all intents and purposes, the windows are bars, the doors are locked, you know. And, yeah, he's been there a very, very long time. And having never been convicted of a crime, per se. And that's what our laws are like. So they essentially allow this to go on virtually indefinitely, as long as the doctors decide you need it. And we've now added a clause, it's called the extended leave provision. It's based on a sort of thing called community treatment orders. So in BC's Mental Health Act, the extended leave provision allows you to actually be good enough. You're healthy enough, you're happy enough, you're competent enough to leave hospital now. Nevertheless, they can still force you to take your medications or come in every week to get electroshocked again or anything like that. That's the extended leave provision they have now, which itself can also go on indefinitely. You get this Well, I've said a lot, but I'll just finish the one other aspect of the laws, which are very disturbing, which is the appeals process. And basically, there is virtually none. So there's no judicial oversight to this. You can't, like, say, well, I don't want to, let me go to court. You would actually have to go out of your way to hire a lawyer, launch a lawsuit, and all these kinds of things. The established appeal process is simply meeting with an administrative tribunal. The hospital appoints one person, usually it's your treating doctor. You can appoint one person, and then there's a sort of quote-unquote independent person who's usually somebody who's embedded in the system already and kind of is used to turning down these appeals. And so we found historically that about 25% of appeals succeed. So it's a very weak process, and it's very difficult now to even get legal representation to go through that process. You usually have to do it yourself. So you might be emotionally disturbed, having trouble in your life, whacked up now on some drugs, and you have to show up at this tribunal and convince these three people that you deserve to be let go. And it's very challenging. And I know that it's become almost impossible to get legal representation because we only have one group in British Columbia, the Mental Health Law Program out of Vancouver from the Community Legal Assistance Society, that provides that kind of representation for people who've been incarcerated against their wills. They're funded by the government. And they last year said they had to turn down 400 people. So 400 people like you and me, incarcerated against their wills for God knows what reason, maybe semi-legitimate, maybe totally not. We won't know because they could not get legal representation to actually even go before this tribunal and appeal their incarceration.
Okay, so I mentioned this to a friend of mine after I learned about it at the discussion with Robert Whitaker the other night. And we'll talk later about Robert Whitaker and why you brought him and some of the information that he's publishing, some of the research. And my friend's response was, I was telling her about this preemptive. It's preemptive, basically. It's sort of like why we went into Afghanistan or Iraq is not that they have any weapons. It's that maybe they have weapons, right? It's always this preemptive thing seems to be happening a lot in our world. And her response was that where do they take them? Because they've shut down a lot of the hospitals, right? So where are people going? Are they going in Harper's new jails?
Well, that's it. Like the saving grace, in my opinion, right now, is that the mental health system is pretty underfunded. And I think, and lucky for us that it is, because it has these extraordinary powers. But at the same time as it's been getting them, there's been a diminishment in support right across the board, even for hospitals, right? And as we know, community support structures have disappeared. So that's just it. They have to turn a lot of people away. And that's a story in and of itself, is who is up at the hospital. Well, if you go up there right now, most of the people in the hospital, like, and by most I mean probably 99 to 100% of the people in the psychiatric hospital in Victoria, are there against their wills. So these are people who don't think they need to be there, who don't want to be there, and are being treated anyway. And they are particularly there for a reason. That's because the average psychiatrist believes they are worse than the person who might go in and say, you know what, I'm really not feeling well, I think I need help, what can you do for me? That person is sent home. That person may be given drugs because they're not considered an emergency. Great, you know, this is the attitude of a psychiatrist. You're aware of your difficulty, you're making reasonable decisions by looking for help, therefore you're not as sick as that bozo over there who doesn't even know he's sick. So when you hear from people who say, you know, what's this guy talking about, my son or my daughter, is really not well, and I took them to the hospital, and not only did they not get treated against their will, they were sent home without any help. And that's right, that's the flip side of this story. Our system is based on a model that actually believes strongly in force, and if it's not using force, it actually thinks that's you progressing towards health, and therefore you need less help than the person who's refusing the treatment. And that's really unfortunate, because most people, as would common sense would say, and so does the science say, that if you participate in your own healing, if you turn to people for help, you trust them enough to turn to them for help, and they reach out to you, that can be an enormously healing process. Conversely, if you don't want the help, you're not ready for the help, you don't trust the people who are trying to help you, that can be a very damaging process and ultimately make you much, much worse and make the whole situation much worse. And that's what we see happening in our system. So yeah, it's not like that we have this rampant thing going on. That said, we have the legislation in place to do it, i.e., if they had the resources to actually visit every home in Victoria and ensure that you and I were taking our drugs, they have the legislation to do that. Right,
they can
now knock
on your door?
That's right. In fact, they do it. I don't know. I can't give you numbers on how many are actually going on right here in Victoria right in this moment. But because this is privacy, of course. But they have the legislation, and I know that it has occurred, that there's the roving, you know, mental health teams that will ensure that an extended leave provision is enforced. So they'll actually literally visit you at your home and make sure you take your medications in the morning. And they may return at night. Or they may give you an injection that lasts 30 days or a couple months. They have that sort of technology now that some of these drugs can have a slow release program. So they'll do something like that to ensure that you stay on these medications. So the legislation to do that, and we have the infrastructure to do that. What we don't have right now is the resources to do that at the scale that these people want to do it. The legislation's in place, but not the money. But that's the point. If you've heard this term early intervention, that's what you were just referring to. And that is a big movement right now. So they don't want to only treat people who are actually having a mental health crisis of some kind. They want to treat people before they have it. And so there's a really strong movement on to do this thing called early intervention. And it's like, the logic is this, because people like Robert Whitaker are showing, you know what? Nobody's getting better on these drugs. So what's happening? And so what the psychiatrists and the dominant model is saying, or the dominant believers in the system are saying, well, it's only because we're not getting them early enough, and they're not staying on them long enough. So they're passing legislation too, like in Australia right now. They just passed legislation trying to make sure that every three-year-old child is screened for mental health stuff. They're going to start that early. We have people in British Columbia, we had some stats come out, we have two-year-olds on antidepressants. So this whole mental health screening thing, that's what that's all about, right? It's like, try to find you long before you're actually having any kind of crisis and say, you know what, you could be prone to depression. You might someday develop schizophrenia, so we better start treating you with these drugs now. And see, that doesn't cost a lot of money. It costs the system money insofar as it's the prescription medication costs money, but you can drug a kid at school. He's not getting any infrastructural support, so it's just the cost of the drug. And in fact, that's what we see. Or we see the cost, the amount of money our society is spending on these medications going up and up and up and up. And like, I mean dramatically up. Like psychotropic drugs right now are pretty much, if you put them together, the biggest selling drugs in North America. So this is not like small potato stuff, right? Benzodiazepines, antidepressants, antipsychotics, these things that 20 years ago were used by maybe 2-3% of the population at most, in most cases, are now being used by 10-15-20% of the population, and it's just going up.
One thing I remember Robert mentioning is the book. I forget what he called the book, but I've seen the book, and I agree with Robert when he says that we're all in there. That there is a diagnosis for everybody. Whatever it is you're feeling, they can label you with something, and there's a drug that will quote fix it. And it's my understanding too that if you in order to be on a disability pension, you have to be labeled with something, and you have to be taking the drugs, right, in this province.
Sorry, what you're saying? What
do you know about that? If you happen to get taken into the hospital, mm-hmm. and they find a label,
right.
for you and start,
yes.
prescribing the drugs, and then they offer you an opportunity to go on a disability pension,
right.
because you're obviously incapable of ever functioning ever again, and you need these drugs for the rest of your life, so they say. So Robert was saying that I think it was 800 people a day in the U.S. are going on disability,
he's got some interesting numbers. The 1,000 per day that he's talking about, kids and adults together, is people falling, mentally ill, generally. But he had the numbers showing that the disability rates are going up dramatically. And what's interesting about that analysis that he's done is he's showing that these are actually people who are severely disabled, essentially. They are becoming non-functional. So they're not just people who might end up with a label of being this or that or the other, but they're not only have that label, but literally are not able to hold down a job anymore, and that those numbers are going up, and that's really concerning, really. So we're not only not curing these, we seem to be making these diseases, if they are that, much worse.
So do you think he was suggesting that the drugs are making it worse?
Oh yeah, he was definitely suggesting that. It's called, the book's called Anatomy of an Epidemic, and that's the primary theme of his analysis. He's looking at what are the long-term outcomes, and how many studies have we done in that area, and it's sad how few we've actually done, but when you look at those, you see fairly consistently that the people who take these medications, psychotropic medications, over the long term, their outcomes tend to be far worse than people who manage to really minimize their use of them or not use them at all. And that's really important for our society to start to grapple with, for sure, because people think the opposite. They believe the opposite. And what Whitaker shows very strongly is that the scientists who actually do the research in this area have been in agreement on this issue for a long time. And they've known that this is happening, largely. But back in 1988, when Prozac became so popular, the industry saw, wow, there's a lot of money to be made. And so, as he phrases it, this scientific failure was reframed and turned into a marketing campaign. And it's the marketing campaign that most people have now believe. They don't understand the science. They don't know the science. They believe that the marketing campaign is reflective of what the science says. And interestingly, the average psychiatrist you talk to will actually believe it too, because most of them, it seems, are not actually looking at the research literature. They're believing what they're being told by the pharmaceutical company representatives who visit them and give them, you know, little pitches for their drugs. One other thing I want to say about the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, it's called. That is a whole other feature of this, is that thing has expanded and expanded and expanded and expanded, really for one reason. People have looked into the history of it and the politics behind it. And it was essentially to give insurance companies in the U.S. diagnostic categories for these things so that psychiatrists could bill for these conditions. And so they just keep broadening it for that very reason. Well, you know, the more conditions we have, the more we can bill for. And that's what's really driving that agenda. And so we do have this problem now that, I mean, I did one the other day. I'm everything. I'm schizophrenic. I'm severely depressed. I have bipolar disorder. I have everything. Like, if I just answered honestly, this is how, when I was doing some screening tests online, you know, put out by reputable organizations, National Institute of Mental Health, or reputable groups putting out these screening tests, and I fell into every category just because, I guess, because what? I let my mind rove. You know, sure, I do think about suicide. Sometimes. Why not? It seems like an interesting thought to me. Sometimes that's driven by despair. Other times it's just driven by curiosity, right? But the screening test doesn't refine that. They don't say, are you an artist who sometimes, or someone who wants to be an artist, who might have a creative mind, who might sometimes try to imagine what it's like to commit suicide, who sometimes maybe even tries to imagine, put yourself in the mind space of a character in a play who might want to commit suicide, and then find yourself amazingly, you know, in tune with that feeling? You know, they don't refine the test in that way. They just ask you something like, do you ever have suicidal thoughts? So if I answered honestly, I end up depressed. Same with schizophrenia. You know, do you ever hear voices? Well, yeah, sure, right? My own voice in my head is a weird one, and then sometimes it's changing, and then sometimes I'm hearing your voice. I don't know, is that because I have some sort of audio memory? Just that's all, that my mind works like a tape recorder, or am I partly schizophrenic? You know, well, that's going to probably just depend on something like the degree of fear of my response to those reactions. And that's the danger of those kinds of screening processes, is that if I didn't have the knowledge and confidence that I have from my research, that would have scared me. You know, that would have made me actually get worse, I think, by suddenly going, oh my God, I'm schizophrenic. Oh my God, I'm bipolar. I better get medication. I better get help before this gets worse, right? And that's what happens to people.
This is the Winds of Change at CFUV Radio 101.9 FM. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to, or you were listening to, a pre-recorded interview that I had with Rob Wypont recently. And I will play the second half of that shortly, but we just have a little bit of housekeeping. First of all, let's look at the weather. It was sort of sunny when I cycled up here today, a little bit cloudy. There is rain in the forecast, but sort of warmer weather. But yeah, it does show rain for the weekend. We will not have to worry about drought yet. An announcement, the Greater Victoria Concert Band will be performing their annual spring concert on Saturday, June 4th at 7:30. The concert will be held at the Alex Golden Hall at 907 Pandora Avenue, where that's just right on Pandora, where there's all that construction, $500,000 worth of city money in quotes, beautify that area. Basically, I guess the poor and homeless people who visit our place next door will no longer have green space to hang out on Pandora Green. So anyways, there's this concert at the Alex Golden Hall on June 4th with the Greater Victoria Concert Band, and there will be a variety of wonderful concert band music performed by two ensembles, and all ages are welcome. Proceeds go to the Concert Band, which is a nonprofit community organization supporting music and the arts in Victoria for all ages. For more information, go to www.gvcb.ca. I'm going to play a little music. I have another announcement and also some music. And this is a song by the band called Ophelia. And for people who are familiar with Ophelia, she's probably one of the best examples, literary examples of a woman who was sort of driven to madness. She was in love with Hamlet, and he was going through his own situation, trying to deal with the ghost of his father, who he thought was murdered by his uncle, who just recently married his mother, and so he sort of took it out on Ophelia a little bit, and she went a little loopy and killed herself. I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but it is, 600 years old. A great story, one of my favorites, and so I'm going to play a little music from the band called Ophelia. Is the song, and then we'll be back with the second half of The Winds of Change, so stay tuned.
Want to know what's going on around UVic? Pick up a copy of The Martlet, free every Thursday. Want to follow breaking stories and get updates? Visit our newly redesigned website anytime at martlet.ca. The Martlet is the independent student news source for the campus and community. The Martlet has been covering stories from the unique perspective of UVic students since 1948. Think independent. Think The Martlet.
Where have you gone?
just survived the end of the world crisis. I don't know if the world ended for you, or I'm speaking with a different Rob, and the original one got raptured or whatever, right? but you know, when you think about the numbers of people who believe literally in this book that's 2,000 years old, and all the people in this book who heard voices, right? Yeah. I mean, the father of Israel, Abraham, heard a voice that he perceived was God and told him to take his only son that he and his wife Sarah had been trying to conceive for years and years, and they were getting old, and they finally have this son, and some voice tells him to take this son up the mountain and kill it as a sacrifice, and he does this. He takes this child up and up and up the mountain. I don't know what he was thinking the whole time they're climbing the mountain, and then luckily he heard a different voice that told him, oh no, it's okay, I want a sheep instead, you know? And this guy's the father of Israel, right? But if you or I say that we heard a voice in our head, then it's off to the hospital and you're on drugs for the rest of your life. So, yeah, it's really interesting. I really appreciated what you said at the event about how, well, and what Robert said too, about how, you know, we all have depression. Like, we go through times of depression, and the people who are best able to cope in the long term are the people who just acknowledge that that's just something that they're going through and that they're going to get over it, and you know, and they make life changes to help them cope rather than just depend on a drug. And I really appreciate what you said too, and it's something I've believed for a long time, is that in other cultures, people who have, you know, visions are considered shaman or healers of some sort. Right? Have you done a lot of research on that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I think it's very, very important. In fact, there's a whole movement out there called the Mad Pride Movement, or the Mad Movement, and this is a... And that's not the only one. There's sort of they're coming from different directions, but that's one that's emerged from people who have been diagnosed with mental illnesses who rebel against that diagnosis and say, no, you know, I'm a creative thinker, I'm an artist, I'm a guru, I'm exploring altered states of consciousness, non-ordinary states of consciousness. And at the same time, there's been a movement within psychology, like the transpersonal psychology movement, where these people are looking at a broader view of the human psyche and what's possible. And so, you know, our society's gotten into really a suppression model. If you have an unusual mystical experience, an unusual spiritual experience, if you suddenly feel like you are the Christ or reborn, or that, you know, you're having this unique experience of oneness of the universe, and that you've attained God consciousness, well, this is floridly delusional, to use the words of the chief of psychiatry at the Eric Martin when I interviewed him many years ago. You know, this floridly delusional thinking. And for me, it's like, or people who've explored non-ordinary states of consciousness of different kinds, you know that actually these kinds of experiences can be extraordinary. They can be healing. They can nurture growth and change. They can be transformative. When you interact with people in your culture who've had similar experiences, it can start to change entire communities and cultures. We've seen that historically. We see, as Wade Davis, I think, points out, and a number of other people, Stan Groff, the psychiatric researcher, and Wade Davis, the ethnobotanist, have pointed out, there's virtually no other culture in human history that we know of that did not have the exploration of non-ordinary states of consciousness right at the heart of their culture in some way, usually within some sort of spiritual religious tradition, but not only. So the indigenous people in North America had the psychedelic mushrooms at the heart of their religion. In Mexico, they had the peyote buttons, right? And down in South America, they've got the ayahuasca, you know, and you see this all over the world. It seems that only sort of white, Western, North American, modern culture has somehow extricated that right out of the heart of our culture and of the heart of our religions, largely. I mean, of course, we have the New Age movement that maybe is embracing some of that today. But largely, it's been pruned out. And it's extraordinarily dangerous, because then suddenly it's like we're policing those kinds of feelings. Those are not good feelings. If you have them, you should be afraid of them. You shouldn't explore them. And so lots of people start having, that's it. They get into a fear thing, and they don't go through that process. But there's lots of evidence out there to suggest that if you do embrace it, if you have supports around you, encouraging friends, encouraging family who understand it, who've maybe gone through things like that themselves, who can just provide safe space, you don't maybe you can go a little while without having to worry about your housing or worry about, getting to your job on time, because sometimes these are very powerful experiences. So if you can do that, that actually you can go through them, you can process them, they can help you grow and heal, and you plane out again. You actually become again then, usually in most people's cases, quite functional, quite grounded, better than you were before, you know? So I think that's really important. Another component of that I just want to point out is the flip side, is that sometimes there are actually organic physical things that cause this to happen. A fever is an obvious one. I experience quite profoundly weird experiences when I'm feverish. Lots of people do. Certain nutritional deficiencies are known to cause hallucinations, weird reactions. Cardiovascular illnesses can cause them. So it's important to understand that. But unfortunately, if you check yourself into the hospital, perhaps you're thinking, maybe I am sick. Maybe I do have something. I saw some stats on this not so long ago where they showed that a very, very, very small percentage of psychiatrists ever give you a normal physical checkup when you enter the psychiatric hospital. And yet, they had shown that somewhere between 30 and 50% of psychiatric emergencies were related actually to actual physical problems. So not like brain chemical imbalances, which are totally theoretical, but actually physical problems like a nutritional deficiency or a cardiovascular illness. And so it's very dangerous. And I personally know someone who was treated for depression for 10 years until they found a brain tumor in her head. And because of that diagnosis, they never checked her. Because they just never, she said, I'm getting headaches, blurry vision, so lots of classic things. But because she'd been diagnosed early with this, they just thought, you're depressed and you're crazy, you're imagining things, and they give her more meds and everything else. And it was only when she's basically on death's door that they found out, holy cow, you've got this giant brain tumor in your head. And that's not the only story like that I've heard. And so that's the flip side of how concerning this is, that there are bio-organic things we should look at, but at the same time, we really need to open our minds to what the spectrum of possibility for the human psyche is, and that a lot of these things that we're calling bad, terrible experiences are extraordinary gifts that people are going through. There's a wonderful play that CBC Radio ran years ago, Crazy Like a Fox, by Darren McDonald, I think his name is. He works with Daniel McIver sometimes, well-known Canadian playwrights, and he tells his own story of basically going mad and ending up in a psychiatric hospital, but how much he learned from it and how he became so troubled by what our system was doing, and that for him it was a psycho-spiritual experience that he felt valued his artwork and everything else. And so I think people need to hear that message out there, just because right now we stigmatize this stuff terribly.
Yeah, in a big way. I sometimes think too, that if people are confronting whatever challenge in their life, that if you have money, you can take yourself away. You can go to a retreat. You can have a mud bath. You can talk to therapists. But if you don't have money, where do you go? The drugs are really the option that's offered. And another interesting thing that Robert mentioned. And I had to check with a friend to say, did he just really say that? Because I wanted to make sure I had heard it right. And so I'll check with you, too. He said that meant there is no connection between chemical imbalance in the brain and mental illness. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. He does the history quite well, in great detail, and I encourage everyone who's interested to read his book, because he really elaborates in great detail and satisfies... in 2 minutes I can't summarize it so well that you won't be going, well, wait, what about this or what about that? But he does that really well in the book, where he covers all the bases. But essentially shows that they never really had no one ever looked at a brain and went, ah, look, we've discovered that all these depressed people have this or that, or low serotonin being the obvious one that people have heard about. Oh, so all depressed people have low serotonin. No one ever did that. What happened was they were using these antidepressants for something else. They discovered that in certain cases, some small percentage of people seem to rise out of their depression as a result. Then they said, well, what is the drug doing? They found that the drug was affecting serotonin movement in the brain in a certain way. So they hypothesized from that that, oh, maybe depressed people have low serotonin. So they proceeded to investigate that. In fact, they found the opposite, that no, there was no, well, not the opposite, but they found that there was no correlation. You could be happy as a clam and have low serotonin. You could be depressed as all get out and have really high serotonin and everything in between. There was really no correlations that they could find. And they pretty much, the most people just kind of gave up then, but there's been, since the antidepressants became so popular, after that, when they turned it into a marketing scheme, some research continued to be done. And so Robert Whitaker overviews that research. But essentially, that's what we found again and again and again, is that there's no correlation. Ditto with schizophrenia. At some point, they developed these antipsychotics, and it's found that they reduced dopamine levels in a certain way for a certain period of time, and said, oh, perhaps schizophrenia is high dopamine. And so they investigated that and have found the same thing. That no, in fact, there isn't that direct correlation. So really, we have no actual chemical imbalance theory of any mental illness right now. In fact, if you look at the research agenda for the next Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is the Bible of all this stuff, they say two things very, very clearly. Like, it's not controversial. It's only controversial in the world of people who do not know. In the scientific literature, it's just not controversial at all. They say two things. One, we cannot accurately diagnose any mental disorder. You can't consistently do that. If you put 5 psychiatrists in a room with 10 different people, they're not going to agree on who has what and why, and they don't even agree on the methodology for doing that. So the categories of how we decide who's mentally ill or not are very unclear. It's pretty subjective. That's one side of it. The second side is that there's no biochemical markers of any kind for any mental disorder in the entire 500 or so pages of the diagnostic manual. So for schizophrenia, we don't know what it is. For depression, we don't know what it is. There's no, if we do submit you to brain scans, if we do test your brain chemical levels, even if we do all that, we have not found any consistent marker of any kind. So they admit that quite readily, you know, and that's important for people to understand. So really what's going on in terms of psychiatric medications is a gigantic experiment. And sure, we know some people feel they do better, largely because both the antidepressants, antipsychotics, and the benzodiazepines, the three really major categories of drugs, have a sedating, sort of tranquilizing effect. So some people just do better with that because they're very highly stressed. Maybe they are experiencing really unusual feelings, and so it just makes them feel better sometimes if they don't have that at quite the racing pace. So some people do better in their own opinion, and they voluntarily take those drugs. And maybe that's fine, right? In the same way some of us might support, you know, recreational marijuana use or other types of drug taking. We say, look, if you're informed, you've done the research, you know the dangers, and you've decided this works for you, okay. Maybe we can support that, right? The danger is those people are out, then start promoting it to everybody else often, right? They're going, it worked for me, it should work for you. Mm-hmm. And the statistics show that the vast majority of people, it either doesn't affect or it affects really, really negatively over the long term. And that's what we as a society have to be ready to acknowledge. And those people are usually dismissed or said, oh, well, you didn't do enough meds, or we didn't get you on them early enough, or, you know, or you're not on the right one yet. We'll switch them for you, and all this kind of stuff can go on.
Well, that's certainly a concern for me. I mean, it's like with anything, you know, any pain or anxiety or whatever it is that I'm experiencing in my body, you know, sure, there's a pill I can take to mask it, but ultimately I want to get at the root cause of it. I want to get to the source of it. And it seems like what's happening is people are just put on these meds, and then as long as they're willing to continue taking them, they can continue taking them for as long as they want, and we don't really know the long-term effects of biologically even of what's going on. And then there's cases like Tucker Gomberg, who took his own life after he started taking antidepressants. You know, Angela Bischoff did her tour a few years back and sort of trying to educate people about the connection between suicide and antidepressants. You know, he's not the only guy that did that. I remember reading a fellow named R.D. Lang years ago, who said that our society is what's screwed up. You know, this for-profit rewarding the greedy system of, you know, destroying the earth and pretending like all of that's good. That's what's crazy. And if you actually fit into that, those are the people who maybe we want to question. You know, if you have trouble fitting into that, then you're actually quite sane. And it seems to me like what we've been talking about here today, Rob, is with this proliferation of meds and this whole industry that's grown up around it. You know, I wonder if it wasn't a for-profit industry, would it be happening to the same extent it is? It seems to me that it's just really market-driven. It's just driven by big pharma. Do you agree with that?
Oh yeah, it's a major factor, and I think the last time I looked at this, pretty much pharmaceuticals are the biggest profit-making industry on the planet in terms of the amount of profit relative to cost, sort of thing, right? So they might not be in total numbers, but there's a lot of money being made, you know, untold billions, and there's definitely really, really intensive marketing campaigns. I heard some stats from a McGill University study that said the average amount of money that's spent per doctor in Canada by pharmaceutical companies doing direct marketing to doctors is about $18,000 per doctor. So that's how much being said. So that's a lot of money. And that's just on the marketing side of it, right? And of course, in the United States, they have direct-to-consumer marketing at a scale that we don't have here. So there's tons and tons of money going into that. And there's no question that that is a driving force. And another part of that is the pill-popping culture we have, right? The magic bullet, give me a quick fix. You know, it's like I want to go to McDonald's quickly for my food. And, you know, oh, I'm having some, you know, weird little dysfunctionality emerging in my life that's making me not accomplish the things I want. Give me a pill for that because I just don't even want to deal with this, you know. So I think that's part of it as well, this tendency we have to just want an easy, simple solution. And for these very reasons that you talk about, like maybe there's another reason that we are getting more instances of apparent extreme states of consciousness, that because our society is so troubled and there's so many bad things going on, that, yeah, maybe that's one of the reasons people are falling into depressions. Maybe that's another reason that people are looking for alternative ways of thinking and becoming almost drawn towards non-ordinary states of consciousness. And I think so. I mean, so as a result, you know, what are we seeing? We're seeing then a crisis occurring in society around this issue. And that's why I think it's important to start talking about it, because there may indeed be a seed of something very important in this, that quite separate from the fact that pharmaceutical companies are pumping this down our throats, but maybe there's something really going on for us as individuals and as a society that's important to start talking about and saying, well, what's happening for us? And I think that we can really see that vividly when we talk about, well, how are we even defining this thing? Because on the one hand, you know, if you are supposedly, you know, going to kill yourself, it's interesting because you can kill yourself and be mentally ill or not, right? We don't even know how they're making that decision, right? Was that suicide caused by mental illness or not? I don't know how they make that decision. But on top of that, of course, you can have emphysema and smoke. That's not a mental illness, right? We haven't defined that yet as a mental illness. We may at some point. But right now, you can do that and you're considered sane and reasonable. But if you just do something a little bit weirder, and that's the key to this stuff, like conventional society accepts that we destroy the environment, that we're polluting our air such that we know 10,000 people in Canada a year are dying from urban air pollution. We know that. But that's okay. That doesn't mean we as a society are mentally ill. It doesn't mean people who drive cars are mentally ill and, you know, presenting a danger to themselves and others. No, that's not the case. But if you walk down the street naked and scream at cars, you're mentally ill, right? And that's something as a culture we really need to grapple with, this whole notion that really it's our definitions for mental illness is subjective and they're very, very culturally conditioned. And it's scary. Right, because we see that at a meta level, where somebody like George Bush or whoever, right, can be making proclamations about illusory things, like there we know there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We know this. And then and be obsessed about it, can launch a war as a result of it, and then be proven wrong, and then go, oh, well, no, I never said that. You know, it's clearly you could define that as the operation of a mental illness. I had a profoundly delusional belief. I was so convinced of it, I tried to convince the world it was true, even when they were telling me all the evidence shows the opposite. I denied them. Then when they were proven right, I denied I ever said it, right? That sounds like a mental illness to me, if we were going to call one that. But that's, so these are the questions we get into anyway, right? But I just want to say, I don't even like the term mental illness. We've never, you know, it's a stigmatizing, dirty, mean, rotten word. And I don't think it should be applied to anybody, you know? It's terrible. And I think it does so much more harm than help in most cases. And I just think we should throw it out, you know? I mean, we use it because it's become conventional. We know what we mean when we say that, okay, we're talking about a category of people. So I'd like to say people diagnosed with mental illnesses so that we clarify that this is a label that's been imposed upon you by somebody else, at least that clear. But I'd rather see that purged from it altogether. Let's just talk about people sometimes struggle. People sometimes have real difficulties. People sometimes have very unusual experiences. Okay, that's, I think, a given. We see that in society. People don't necessarily experience mental illnesses, and I think people are very rarely, if ever, mentally ill in that sense.
Yeah. When people talk to me about the street news, and often, too often, they'll say, well, what, you know, what causes that? These are genuinely concerned individuals, and they'll say, well, most of those people are mentally ill, right? And I really have to try to explain that, you know, no, I wouldn't want to even suggest that. And what happens out there is, you know, if you're homeless and you can't sleep through the night because you don't want your body violated or your stuff stolen, so you end up staying up a lot, or you end up taking drugs that will help you stay awake at night. And, you know, how long could you do that before someone labeled you as mentally ill? You don't have to go very long without sleep before you start hallucinating, right? So I think it's really important that this discussion, and I really thank you for bringing Robert here, because that really was he's an amazing guy. And he's based in the U.S., and his whole body of research, we would invite people to go and have a look at that. But I'm concerned locally. So basically, we can't count on the BC Schizophrenia Association for any help here. Maybe you could speak to that. And also, you mentioned the BC Civil Liberties Association hasn't really taken this on.
Well, this is an area that's really complicated and difficult, and I think people need to be aware of that. Because of the actual lack of science underneath this, in fact, most of what's going on in the area of mental health is political. So they're power players and people who are pushing agendas. And unfortunately, we don't really have anybody representing the kind of point of view that I am trying to talk about right now, which is the representing the civil rights of the average person who might get incarcerated against their wills and treated against their wills. That is a voice that is not really getting out there. So I don't want to say the BC Schizophrenia Society doesn't do anything good. Like, I have some friends that have done volunteer work for them, and they run, you know, nice support groups and things like that, where people can meet with other people who are struggling and kind of share stories and things like that. So they have some good programs. But politically, their essential position on forced treatment is very strong, and they intervene in court cases, and they promote this, and that's what I object to most with them. Canadian Mental Health Association, similar kind of thing. They have some policies that support the rights of mental health patients, but they aren't really strong advocates for them. They tend to represent, as BC Schizophrenia Society tends to represent family members of people who've been diagnosed with mental illnesses, Canadian Mental Health Association and Capital Mental Health here tend to represent those people as well as mental health professionals, and that's who's really dominating the agenda right now. So people who have a particular way of looking at this, which is, I know what's wrong with you and I want to help you. And I don't want to say they never do help people. Sometimes there's some great people doing that kind of work, and they do help people. But they need to be more conscious of the fact that they are suppressing and not helping another point of view. And they often, in fact, go out to shut that point of view down. And that other point of view is this one we're talking about, the kind of civil rights perspective and the questioning of the science perspective, because they don't tend to question the science either. So there's them. There's the BC Civil Liberties, which I don't understand because I've been bothering them personally for years. And back in 1983, they had a very progressive position acknowledging that the Mental Health Act was draconian and took away people's rights at an unfair level. Well, the Mental Health Act in British Columbia has gotten far worse, and they have not really issued a position statement since about 1998, when they issued a press release saying, ooh, these proposed changes are terrible, but that was the extent of it. The changes came in, and then they got even worse after that. And since then, they've never really issued any press releases, they've not updated their policy, and I don't understand that, other than to be suspicious, because I bothered them and explained it to them at great length. I can only be suspicious that maybe they have some of these people we talked about earlier who sort of bought into the model. They believe in the science. Maybe they have a family member who's been diagnosed who they believe should be on medication, so they don't want to take this on their board somewhere or whatever, or just this attitude that they haven't educated themselves yet, because I believe if they were educated, how could they not be concerned about the Mental Health Act? Because it makes U.S. anti-terrorism legislation look like fuzzy-wuzzy, our Mental Health Act. It is so extreme. And if it was used as it's designed, that's what it would be. It would be like the ultimate, you could not design a better police state law than our BC Mental Health Act, really. It's absolute power in the hands of one person, essentially, right? It's terrible. So BC Civil Liberties has not come to bat for some reason. And I don't know why, again, because I know they communicate with Community Legal Assistance Society in Vancouver a lot, who've identified this as the major mental health crisis in the province right now, this thing I was talking about earlier, people not even being able to get legal representation anymore, 400 people last year alone, who can't even get legal representation to fight this, when even in that minimal little administrative tribunal that they get. So there's that group. The provincial government has made its position clear. They fund hospitals a bit, but community supports not at all. So there's this smattering of lower-level organizations that are involved here that do some positive work in this area, but most of them, if they get any government funding, have to be very careful because it's perceived as political activism if you start speaking out for the rights of patients.
I have a theory that people can disappear easily inside that system, that they, if they can get swept up off the street and incarcerated against their will, and then if they have no family or friends, you know, it's quite possible that they could just be disappeared. This is my paranoid. You can label me as a paranoid schizophrenic or something as a consequence. So I don't suppose you've done any research into that, but that's just one of my theories. But we're kind of out of time, Rob. I'm wondering, where would you direct people if they want to further find out about this?
Well, you can start researching on the internet. Mind Freedom, the organization in the United States, is a good sort of, they represent hundreds of grassroots organizations around the world. So check out their website. You can email me, I guess, because I'm going to do something with this list of people I got from the talk and maybe get some sort of group going out of Victoria. So my website, robwipon.com, and you can just see the about contact and contact me, rob@robwipon.com. So that's one thing. Canada-wide, there's not really. There's the Ontario Coalition Against Psychiatric Assault, so they do some work in this area, but there's not a lot there. So, yeah, can't quickly. There's some great books, you know, Whitaker's books, and Mind Freedom has a bookstore, which will give you, you know, R.D. Lang and those kinds of people who've written in this area and are great thinkers. And I can tell you exactly where those people are disappearing. They're disappearing into the residential care system. That's where they're disappearing. So people can read my article in Focus magazine this month about what's going on in our long-term care facilities, because, yes, that's exactly what happens. Some people get so debilitated by the medication and electroshock that they have to get into long-term care, and they just get stuck there. And we're using these drugs way out of proportion to how much we should be using them. And that's what my article's about this month in Focus magazine, exploring just the extent of the use of antipsychotic medication to control people in long-term care facilities. So you're not totally paranoid. I think that some people do disappear in that kind of way.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much for what you're doing here, Rob.
All right, thank you.